That's right.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What you want to do is you want to list these things top to bottom, top to bottom, top to bottom, top to bottom. And once you get all those people, places, and things that you're resentful at, then you come over to two. Here's the reason you don't do this. The human nature will tell you that it's natural to go left to right, left to right, left to right. You with me? Ain't right, not in this one. The instructions are up here. You ain't going to read them because you're a good bunch of drunks. I got to know a lot of you. So just follow along. It's pretty easy. Once you get these done, then you come back and you do this. And the reason you don't go left to right is because if I write down that ex-wife and I list one of the things she did, I'm done. I'm pissed off again. I can't get the rest of this out. But if you just list the people, places, and institutions, then you come back and you put, I'm angry at this person because. A lot of people are thinking, well, what if I've got that ex-wife and I'm angry about more than one thing? You put her name here and you list the things. You with us? Here's the deal. When you get into this column, 9 words or less. I know you guys that have been around here for a minute had that guy show up at the legal pad and he's written this novel. Don't do it. Please don't do it. Because what you're going to do, you're going to hand your guy this sheet and he's going to say, you're angry at your ex-wife. It says here because she always had to be right. What does that mean, Larry? Well, she had this need that she always had to be right. Problem with that is she was right a lot of the time. I just didn't want to own it. You see what I'm saying here? So all you're doing is you're writing a couple of words. So that what the sponsor is going to ask you, he says, what does this mean? And you're going to tell him. You ain't got to write all that stuff down. 9 words or less. Blow through this. Let's get her done. Come over to the third column. Hang on a second. I'm going to go backwards a little bit. Bear with me. This sheet is in your packet. Not going to go over it except to tell you, visit this sheet when you're doing your inventory. Reason being, it's going to give you some comparisons here. The business, the personal. But the big one is you wise guys out there that think, you know what all these words mean? Quiz yourself. Make sure you understand the meaning of these words. You've got a glossary that will tell you.
There's two words on there that seem to have very similar definitions. One of them is selfish, the other is self-seeking. Somebody suggested to me, and it works for me, my experience is, selfish is in my mind. Selfish, self-seeking is how that selfishness manifests itself in my actions. So it can start as a selfish thing, and then I become self-seeking when I inflict it upon you.
It's up here. The sheet's not in there? Brian. Guys, if you need this sheet, email me. aahog1@comcast.net. Everybody, some of you don't have it. That's because Frank's a slack dog. All right, you ready? All right, the next one is an example of resentments. When you get all these people, places, and things down, you think, I'm done. Go back and look at this. There's a list of people. There's a list of institutions and principles. A lot of us don't know what the hell a principal is. You think it's somebody that runs a high school. Well, it's not.
They may be on there, though.
An institution could be the Ten Commandments. It could be child support. It could be alimony, adultery, homophobia, Jesus Christ. These are things that are principles. Institutions are these things. The Bible, marriage, society. Okay? Take a look at the people. There's a sponsor on here somewhere. There he is. Visit this sheet because when you think you're done, you might want to rethink it. Okay? Then we're going to go over here to step three, or the column three. Column three says, what does this affect? There are three basic instincts of life. We all got them. The first one is social instinct. We're herding animals. We love being together. I want you to like me. I want to be your friend. Let's hang out. You with me? But that's not always going to happen. The social instinct, self-esteem, how I feel about me. Personal relationships, how I feel about you or how I perceive you feel about me. Ambitions, our plans to gain acceptance, power, recognition, prestige in the future. Okay? Get a series of check boxes. Check them off. If this thing affects any of these instincts, check it off. When you're checking these things off, if you don't know or you're unsure, don't try to be the golden boy because you won the prize. Leave it blank, and a competent sponsor will walk you through and say, don't you think that that would affect this? Do you follow?
For amplification, Bill Wilson did not spend a lot of time talking about it in the big book. He spent some time, though, in the 12 and 12. I invite you to read the first half of the fourth step in the 12 and 12. It does not give any direction on how to do it, but it expands on social, sexual, and security. Those three areas of self, and I challenge anybody, I've yet to find somebody who's found a problem that falls outside of social, sexual, or security issues. If it did not affect one of those instincts, it wouldn't make it on this list. You have to affect one of those areas of self, otherwise, I don't care.
We desire to be with each other. That's the social. Security instinct's pretty self-explanatory. We need money. We need homes. We need to be secure emotionally. Okay? We got to survive. We got to pay the landlord. Okay? You check off those boxes. And this is about the ambitions, your plans to gain material wealth or dominate or depend on others in the future. Come on over to the last one, the sexual instinct. God gave us this to recreate. It's a spiritual act. But we take it to extremes, and we're going to get into that in depth in a little bit. But if these resentments that you've checked off, because that's the sheet we're on, affect your sexual instinct, acceptable, which is your sex life is accepted by either society's gods or your own principles, hidden, which is elements of your sex life, which are contrary to society's gods or your own principles. Pretty clear. Or your ambitions regarding your sex life, either hidden or acceptable. And I can assure you, as you go through this, if it doesn't make sense, don't check it. Once again, a competent sponsor steps up and says, well, what do you think about that? All right, you with me on that one?
All right, so far we've done three columns. We're going to skip over to the top middle of 66. The book says it's plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? But see, for the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it's fatal. For when harboring such feelings, I shut myself off from the sunlight of the Spirit. I used to think that drinking made me insane. Here I am apart from a drink. But if I let a resentment cut me off from the sunlight of the Spirit, the book says the insanity of alcohol returns, and then I drink. The insanity always precedes the drink. I used to think it was the other way around. With us, to drink is to die. And it says if we're going to live, like breathing, if I'm going to live, I have to be free of the anger. The grouch and the brainstorm are not for me. They may be the dubious luxury of a normal man, but for me, as an alcoholic, these things are poison. So I turn back to the list. It holds the key to the future. I am now prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. Now check this out. All I've done is made three columns of information. I've written who upset me, what they did, and what part of me is affected. That's all I've done so far. The directions in the book suggest that.
Let me ask a question. How many guys in here are going to do a four-step inventory? We're not doing it while we're here. How many guys have got plans? Okay. Did you kind of get relieved that you don't have to write a novel? This is pretty simple stuff, guys. It's really simple. It's just you and a piece of paper and a pen. All right, it says we're going to look at it from a different angle. We've been talking about these people that have wronged us up here. The IRS and her. Okay? And now we're going to look at it from a different angle, Christian.
Now, how do we look at it from a different angle?
angle.
I wanted so badly to get over those resentments, those fears, and that guilt, that shame, the remorse, the horror, the hopelessness. I wanted so badly to get over that, but I can't remove that myself. If I could, I would. The book suggests we begin to see that the world and its people really dominated us. When I'm looking at this in black and white in front of me, guess what? That kid from 1977, he has dominated some way or in another my life at certain times for the last 34 years. 34 years dominating his life. I've had over 30 years of it dominating my life. And I've seen other people around this fellowship who've had even longer experiences. Dominated. A past action. The book suggests in that state, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill.
In this page, there are 7 death threats. There's 7 death threats on this one page.
Yeah.
You think they might be serious?
It says, how can we escape? We saw resentments must be mastered, but how? We couldn't wish them away any more than alcohol. And here's the gift. And I've sat with guys who've done a fourth step in the past, and they were never taken to this part. That writing will not relieve you of a resentment. Then treatment centers would be turning out sober, recovered alcoholics all the time because they do a lot of writing. Here is where I get the relief. This was our course, the first 100. This is what they did. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though I didn't like the symptoms, their actions, attitudes, and behaviors, and the way that these symptoms disturbed me, they, like me, were sick too. Prayer. I asked God to help me show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When somebody offended me, I can say to myself, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done.
2 series of prayers there.
Now, why am I doing that? Why am I praying for this unfortunate bastard? Why am I praying for this SOB? So I can be free of the resentment. I'm the one who's being spiritually locked up as a result of the resentment. He will not drink over my resentment, even though I wish he would. I will drink over my resentment. I'm not going to drink over what he did to me. I'm going to drink over my inability to deal with what he did to me. People talk about in treatment, people, places, and things. That's what made me drink. No, she never got me drunk once. After I did an inventory, I realized my feelings about her got me drunk. My guilt, shame, remorse, hopelessness, and horror over what happened got me drunk. My resentments got me drunk. And it put it all back on me. Always comes back to me.
Let's skip this next paragraph, please.
Full paragraph down, it says, referring to our list again. Putting out of our minds the wrongs others have done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. Where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? And we added inconsiderate because it shows up on another inventory list.
It shows up in the sex inventory, the word inconsiderate, and we found that it applies throughout the inventory process. So what you're doing is you're making a series of check marks. This is your part in this resentment. I'm angry at her because she always had to be right. Let's follow that thought all the way through. It affected my self-esteem because I knew I was lying because she was sometimes right. I was dishonest because I wouldn't own it because I wanted to be right. I was self-seeking because if I was right, I'm the man. I was frightened because not only was I afraid that she would find out that I knew she was right, but that you would find out that I was living a lie. And I was inconsiderate. And I was inconsiderate to 2 people here, at least. I was inconsiderate to her because I wouldn't give her the credit that she deserved. And I was inconsiderate to myself because had I been honest with her, we could have let this issue go away and probably lived a little more harmoniously. You follow me? Okay. So that is the fourth column of the inventory. This is your part. And if you're going through here and you're unsure what your part is, don't check it. Once again, you got to rely on a competent sponsor to walk you through this. And he'll help you to see your part. I had an experience some years ago with a young man that had moved here from another country. And on his inventory sheet, he had an incident on there where a guy had broken into his house when he was a young kid. Guy came in and beat and raped his mother in front of him. Fourth column was empty. Well, I'm the sponsor. I'm looking at the sheet and I said, "Dude, fourth column's empty. What's your part?" And he just looked at me and said, "Larry, I don't have a part." The point I make with that story is just because those boxes are there doesn't mean you got a part. Don't become the victim. Don't become the martyr. If you got a part and you understand it, you see it clearly, mark it. If you don't, leave it blank. Because once again, the competent sponsor is going to help you see it if you've got it.
Okay, remember, our inventory is ours, not the other man's. So sometimes, and I'll give you another example, a guy that we both know back in Atlanta, when he was 9 years old, was sexually molested while playing in the hallway of his apartment complex over in the projects of Atlanta. Growing up, repeatedly sexually molested by his next-door neighbor. And he made it to his inventory. And his sponsor suggested that while the action that what occurred is not his fault, that's not what this inventory is about. Why are you holding on to the resentment? Why are you continuing to hold on to resentment 30-something years after it happened? The resentment I'm holding on to, because selfishly, it fuels something in me. There's a lot of reasons why you can hold on to a resentment. He wasn't responsible for what occurred to him as a child. He is responsible at the age of 40 plus holding on to the resentment over what happened 30-something years ago. You know, you can dig deep and you can get free. Now remember, we're not doing a fourth column until we started to pray. The specific directions in the book suggest that we list people, places, and institutions, what they specifically did, what it affected. I pray, God help me show them the same tolerance, patience, and pity I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. Now I look for my part. Where was I? Selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, inconsiderate, and afraid. I'm going to be seeing this in a whole new way because guess what? I'm asking God to help me see them as sick people too. If it's just about the writing, that means you have power. That means you can relieve your own alcoholism. And that's not what my book tells me. My book tells me that we need God's power.
Is this stuff making sense to you guys? Are we losing you anywhere here? This is pretty simple stuff, isn't it?
Bottom of 67 says, notice the word fear.
Flip back over to the previous page, page 65, please, and just glance at it because they've done a similar inventory or a sample inventory, and out to the far right side of the inventory, the word fear is bracketed. This is what they're referring to. Okay, go back over to 67.
Skip down two lines. It says, this short word, fear, somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. Fear was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. Fear set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But didn't we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble.
It says this, in 12 and 12, it says that self-centered fear is the chief activator of all my defects. Self-centered fear. Fear blocks me off from so many things that I, you know, like I want to go on a long ride. But the fear in me tells me I don't measure up, I'm not a good enough rider, and I'm probably going to have a problem somewhere between Atlanta and Akron. Not true. My bikes are capable and I'm healthy. But the fear will keep me from doing that. It will rob me of that opportunity. You with us?
It says, we review our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. We asked ourselves why we had them.
Guys, that's important. This fear inventory, it looks just like the resentment inventory, but don't be confused. You don't have to be angry at something to make this sheet. These are things that you're scared of, because the book just told you that you're driven by 100 forms of it. I can be scared of flying, but it doesn't make me pissed off at the plane. I'm scared of snakes, but I'm not angry at them. They do what they do. Frank was telling me about a damn bear chasing him. Were you angry at the bear? He's just doing what he does, man. Get the hell out of my house. Ran his butt out of there, too. I don't even want to go there. Fear is a whole different deal, and it blocks us off from so many things. The book says it's an evil and corroding thread, and the fabric of my existence is shot through with it. He says it. We think it should be classed with stealing because it seems to cause more trouble. It robs me of so many otherwise good times that I might have.
Oh, it says we asked ourselves why we had these fears. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us?
This is where he's at.
Self,
right here.
Self-reliance. I'm going to depend upon me to fix it. Wow. We've already talked about it twice in here. We're seeing that a life lived on self-will can hardly be a success. Self-inflicted upon others and manifesting itself in so many different ways. Man, self-reliance failed me. The question, it goes on to say, self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. I once even had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve that fear problem or any other. It goes on to suggest in the next paragraph, perhaps there's a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis. Bottom of 66 says that this was our course. We're looking at people who have harmed us or done wrong things to us in a different way. We're going to look at them as possibly being sick people. We're going to look at the same way in fear. We've invited God into our world in a third step decision. I'm giving myself to God. He ain't taking nothing. I'm giving it to do with me and build with me. So I'm going to look at this. I'm going to possibly go out on a limb here. Maybe there's a better way. We are on a different basis. What? Trusting and relying upon God.
There's the way you deal with fears. You can't go out and make an apology to an airplane or a snake or a bear. We're living on a different basis. It says, here's how you deal with fears. Because there's a better way. We think so. For now, we're on a different basis. We're on the basis of trusting and relying. Christian, what's the difference in trusting and relying?
You know, you're sitting there at the circus and you're watching the guy on the high wire. And he goes all the way across. And you think, that's pretty good. And then somebody swings a bike over to him. It's got a wheelbarrow on the front. And he's pushing this bike across, and he's got, you know, it looks good, everything's great. And he gets a way across. And then he announces, how many people think I could do that again? Every hand goes up. Who wants to get in the wheelbarrow? Crickets. That's all you hear is a bunch of crickets. I trust God infinitely. I really do. But am I going to act like I trust him by relying upon him? Trust is easy. That's watching the guy do it. I trust that he can do it. Relying is that I'm going to get in the wheelbarrow. And trust that God's got a better plan than I do. Trust that and rely upon God to deliver me safely. Relying upon God. I'm going to do what I'm supposed to do. And I'm going to leave the results up to him.
Because it says that we're in the world to play the role that God assigns, just wow. To the extent.
Isn't that sound a little bit like we talked about? He's the director, I'm the actor. He's the father, I'm the child. He's the employer, I'm the employee. Principal and agent. I'm going to expand upon my relationship with God by relying upon him to be the father, and I'll be the child. To be the principal, I'll be his agent. To be the employer, and I'm his employee. The book tells me after that, being all powerful, he provides what I need. Wow.
It says, just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us. That's doing his will, aligning our will with his. And humbly rely on him, once again, that getting in the wheelbarrow deal. Does he enable us to match serenity with calamity with serenity? Our lives have been calamity all our lives. What we're seeking, serenity. And then it goes on to say, we never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness.
Here's the paradox.
What is it?
It's the way of strength. It says the verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. I used to think that courage was the absence of fear. Courage is in spite of the fear. Because the fear is never as bad as it's never going to be as bad as I thought it was. Up here, it's manifested itself in its boogeyman, this huge, towering. It's so huge, and then I see it, and it's this little teeny tiny thing. It's never as bad as I think it's going to be. So we never apologize to God. Instead, here's a manifestation of that third step prayer. I let God demonstrate through me what he can do.
And then we cry.
How do I get over fears? Just by being brave. How many people did that work for? Nobody. Prayer. I ask God to help to remove my fear and to direct my attention to what he would have me be.
At once we commence to outgrow fear. We commence. Commence means begin.
What does he want me to be? The book suggested in a couple of places, happy, joyous, and free. To fit myself to be of maximum service to him and my fellows. Oh, to be the actor to his director. To be the agent to his principal. To be the child to his father. To be the employer, the employee to his employer.
And once you get done with your fears inventory and you think you're done, go back and revisit this. Here's an example. And there's a whole bunch of them here. So once you're done, go back and revisit this because you want to be searching, fearless, and thorough. Okay?
Now about sex.
Guys, before we go into this, I'm going to ask you, let's keep this thing down to earth because we know what kind of trouble this deal has caused us. And this thing can get spun out of control and we can laugh it up and yuck it up. But the bottom line at the end of the day, it's caused me a lot of heartache. I've harmed a lot of people in my life with this deal right here.
Sex and checks. I've lost more sponsees over money and sex. Fear of it. Not enough of it. The book suggests many of us needed an overhaul there.
Sex isn't always intercourse.
Yeah.
Sex can be a lot of things. I asked my sponsor, we did this inventory a couple of weeks ago in our home group, and my sponsor was there. Bob conducts a four-step workshop that lasts 6 hours at The Rock, and all he does is the four-step inventory. And I said, Bob, give us an example of sexual misconduct. He says, I'm in the choir at church. I'm married. I love my wife. We're happy. But there's this young lady with big boobs in the choir. She's married, happily, and got children. But she stands next to me in the choir. He says, and I, when in between songs, our hands are by our side, and we're touching each other's hands. Nothing ever happened. They touched each other's hands. That's hidden sexual misconduct.
That's an example of Bob's hidden sexual misconduct. The book suggests that we have no judges other than God.
That's an example of a hidden sexual misconduct. They didn't go sleep with each other. He didn't even grab her tits. He just rubbed her hand. She didn't tell her husband, and he didn't tell his wife. You follow?
Book suggests, above all, we try to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes, perhaps. There's one set of voices that cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, base necessity of procreation. Then we got the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage. They think most of the troubles of our race are traceable to sex. They think we don't have enough of it, or it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. The book suggests three lines down, we want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct.
Arbiter is judge. If I am sponsoring a man and he's living a lifestyle other than straight sexual conduct, for instance, a gay man, and he goes into the story about that conduct or that behavior, I don't know anything about it. Who am I to judge it? Or there's some things with his sex life that I have no experience with. I can't judge that. So what do we do with it, Christian?
The book says we all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't.
So it doesn't say all alcoholics. It says human beings. We talked about it earlier when we were talking about the God-directed animals. All humans have sex problems because we got what? Self-will. Mm-hmm. And we abuse this privilege, this God-given thing, to extremes.
It says, what can we do about them? We review our own conduct over the years past. Where have we been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault, and what should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper, and we look at it.
All right. There's that inconsiderate thing we talked about. And it says, where did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy? You're in an outing with your lady, and this real looker comes walking by. She's got attributes that your wife might not have, and you give her a second look, and your wife sees you doing it.
Uh-oh.
Hello. Suspicion? Jealousy? Bitterness, you think? She says, why were you looking at that woman? You never look at me like that. You see how simple this is? Because when you do the sex inventory and you hear it, these things tell you it's that you've gone out and been unfaithful to your partner. No. This is a sexual misconduct inventory. And it says, we put them all down on paper. There are going to be extreme examples of your behavior in the past, and they go here. But you list them top to bottom, top to bottom, top to bottom. There's going to be those nameless people. Maybe not in your life. There's a ton of nameless people in my past. I wouldn't know them if I tripped over them today. Not because they weren't significant. They were victims of my misconduct. You list them. The girl at the Waffle House. That girl that night at the... Don't have to have a name, but you put them here. And what did you do? What did you do to harm this person? And you carry it on over the third and fourth column.
The book suggests in this way we try to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subject each relation to this test. Is it selfish or not? Prayer. We ask God to mold our ideals and then to help us live up to them. We remember always that our sex powers are God-given and therefore good. That was a big deal for me. They're good sex powers. They were given. They're good. Neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed.
It says that you put each one of these to the test. And you got to ask yourself, is it selfish or not? Are you manipulating your way into something you shouldn't be doing? You get what we're talking about here? Is it selfish? And I got to tell you, I'm guilty with doing that with guys. I could find out that you live in my town and you're a builder and I want your business. I'm all of a sudden going to be your best friend. I can have sex with money. The same sound sex ideal. Many people in this room got no idea what that means. When I first heard this term, I thought it meant what I wanted in a relationship, and I put down how tall she needed to be, what her cup size was, and all that business. It's not what they're talking about.
But it can be.
What do we bring to the table?
I have a question. It says, what should we have done instead? Where do we put that on our conversion?
Should you have had that conduct? What instead of doing the fault or the wrong or the harm, you do the opposite. You understand what I'm saying? Okay, are you married?
Yes.
You had an affair with a girl over at the Waffle House?
Yes.
Okay? And wait till I get your wife on the phone, dude. But you go out and you have this affair. What should you have done instead?
That's what I'm saying. Where do I write it down?
You don't. We're not telling you to write it down.
Okay.
It's asking you the question. And you did. Your wrongs. Your inventory.
Okay.
Okay? And I want to be clear on something here. There's nothing in this book that talks about writing down your assets. A lot of people in the fellowship says you write down your faults and your assets. My assets didn't damn near kill me. Let's talk about this sane, sound sex ideal. This is in your packet. This is not something we wrote. We found it from someone that we respect. And this is from an old inventory of his. And all this is an example of what a sane, sound sex ideal could be. Okay? And Christian's going to read that for you.
Number one, a true partner. Someone to share equally in the responsibilities of life. Neither partner feels they are taken advantage of. Number two, an intimate relationship. Someone who can see into me, see the dark and the light. Someone with whom I can take emotional risks and let them in behind the wall that I put up and not abandon me. Totally accepting of me, good and bad, without expectation of change. If that change comes, it comes from God. Number three, a monogamous relationship, sexually and spiritually, where I show reverence and respect of our love and commitment, i.e. I demonstrate that my mate is number one all the time in my life, honor and cherishment. Number four, someone with whom I am free to be truthful, not afraid to be honest, both omission and commission. Number five, my lover, open, honest sex, fantasy realization through caring exploration of our sexual natures. The true goal is pleasure for each other through sexual means to enhance intimacy where two really do become one. Six, fair play, total commitment to harmony through fair, expedient compromise, using the rules to keep our disagreement within bounds and open commitment to a quick, fair resolution to restore harmony to our relationship. Number seven, safe, loving, nurturing home for parenting, emotionally stable, filled with love and self-sacrifice for the good of the family union. Number eight, a balanced relationship, work and play balanced, spending and saving balanced, home and travel balanced. Money is not my God. Love and family are paramount. Number nine, a relationship which nurtures the couplehood, not just the parenthood. So when the nest is empty, our relationship moves to the next chapter. Does not start again. Someone to grow old with. Number 10, someone to grow with mentally, spiritually, and sexually. A non-judgmental support for the betterment of the individuals, which betters the couplehood. Someone who will share in our combined vision of our future and love and our lives to come, with whom I can strive to reach a mutual goal of serene old age, where we can look back on happiness and the journey, not a finishing line. The number 12, my number one fan, supporter, confidant, best friend, lover, spouse, wife, mother, companion, and hero, where we revere each other through sacrifice and love to become one, and that the one we become can give back and help others, including our kids, the program, society, and church, where our lives can be an example of the program, which helps others find happiness, fidelity, and love.
Okay, so that's a pretty good example, or a guideline, as it were, as you try to shape your own sound, sane sex ideal. And then you do what, Christian?
Real quick question. How many people did that just floor you? Had never even conceptualized of a sex ideal that was outside of the confines of what happens in the bedroom. Or in an intimate walking, relationship, be it a marriage or, some kind of relationship like that. This floored me the first time I read it. This is an example. This is a well-written example, a very elaborate example. But the book suggests whatever our ideal turns out to be, I must be willing to grow towards it. I must be willing to make amends where I've done harm, provided I don't bring about more harm in so doing. In other words, I treat sex as I would any other problem. Prayer and meditation, I ask God what I should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if I want it.
There's your caveat. You got to want it.
God alone can judge my sex situation. This is a big one right here. Counsel with others is often desirable.
But
I let God be the final judge. I realize some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. I avoid hysterical thinking or advice.
Hysterical thinking and advice. If you go over to, in this meeting, and you go up to five guys, and you talk to them about any given sexual situation, answers or comments or suggestions or feelings or opinions are going to be all over the place. So you avoid that. I keep this with my sponsor, and he listens. And if he has direction, he'll give it to me.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he's going to take me back to the ultimate source, God, because it tells me that God alone can judge my sex life.
Yeah. The most extreme example I've ever seen of that was a woman walked into the 8111 Club in Atlanta, sat down, they opened up the meeting, did the readings, the prayers, everything was good to go, introduced the topic, she raised her hand and says, just found out I'm pregnant, what do you think? Should I get an abortion?
Woo!
And 50 untrained psychiatrists tackled that. We didn't talk about alcoholism. We didn't talk about the new guy. We didn't talk about a solution. And we had people in that room who were literally coming to fisticuffs over one another because that was an extreme topic. And how dare that be discussed? The most important thing we could have done is, that's an outside issue. We suggest that you get some counsel with people that you know, love, and trust. You know. But there was a guy who showed up at a book study, Larry and I did, and he was shopping for the answer he wanted. Larry, what do you think? What's your opinion about this? No. It wasn't a weed eater. It was a big... The book suggests, suppose we fall short of our chosen ideal and stumble. Guess whose ideal this is? Mine. This is my ideal. This isn't my mom and dad's ideal. This isn't my church's ideal. This is mine. I ask God to help me mold my ideal. And then I ask him to help me live up to it. It's my ideal. This is what I'm shooting for. And Chris Raymer does a real easy exercise. It's called 20-10-5. Write 20 things that you want in a relationship. Healthy things. And take out the 10 that matter the least. And then circle the 5 that matter the most. And it's a challenging exercise. When I got down to it, guess how important big boobs were on my list? They were number 6. They didn't make it on the final 5. Guess what did make it? For me, my experience, a woman who doesn't talk to hear her head rattle. Walking with a relationship with her creator. Supportive of what I do in AA. Loves amorous sex. And wants to be in a healthy relationship. I thought boobs and legs and butt were going to be all over that thing. I'm pretty sure butt's on his, though. He's a butt man. Was there a hand in the back?
I was just, would this be something you would share with your wife?
If you want.
This is somebody else's ideal. It's your ideal. This is another man's. Are you clear with that? This is another man's ideal. If it appeals to you, go with it. Anyway, it says, suppose we fall short. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but it's only a half-truth. It depends on our motives, if
Remember
we're sorry.
That. Here's the test. Is it selfish or not? If my ideal is a healthy monogamous relationship, and I'm going outside of that relationship to get some on the side, who's going to pay the price of that? My ideal is healthy, monogamous. But my alcoholic, selfish, self-seeking side wants to live over here. I can't let the two worlds combine. I can't let them know about one another. Guess what? I'm living a lie, a double life. Guess what's going to catch up with me? Fear, resentment. Makes for more drinking, doesn't it? It's only a matter of time. The book says depends on us and of our motives. If I'm sorry for what I've done and I have an honest desire to let God take me to better things, I believe I will be forgiven and will have learned my lesson. If I'm not sorry, and I'm going to give you an opinion and I'm going to express it with utmost enthusiasm. One rule in our sponsorship family, and it's absolute. If she ain't got time sober, working the steps with the sponsor, leave her alone. Because there's too many new women walking into this fellowship, and there's too many predators who hang out watching Then the girl's just got the hospital plastic cut off her wrist. She's at her first meeting, and guess what? One of us is going to slide up and try to cozy up.
Take the gender out of it. This is a human being that's dying of a disease, the same that you've got. She has the right to get sober.
Thank you.
If you deny her that, you're killing this woman.
Now you try,
because
yeah.
I guarantee you there's a high, hard one that will get her mind off of this book and onto you, and she's going to die. Don't do it. Leave these new women alone. And don't get us wrong. It ain't all of us that are guilty. There's some women out there hitting on these new guys.
Yeah. If you come to our home group, Thursday night, we are not a glum lot. That room is run by women.
Beautiful women.
Beautiful women. Hammers. But if a new girl walks in, you better believe that they're going to tell you what time it is, and they're going to corner her, and they're going to pull her over to the side, and they're going to let her know, you need to watch out for him and him and him. You know, and you need to, and listen, you don't need to worry about that because you now have sisters who are going to carry you. And these women protect their own.
We had a guy come in there, an older guy, and he hit on three of our founding women. And they came to us, and they said, this guy's, group of us guys went over and said, listen, you're not welcome here anymore.
You're not here
to get sober. You're here to be a predator on our women. These are our sisters. Please don't come back with that motive.
He's still in AA. He just kicked out of that meeting. And we have the right to do that.
All right, let's wrap this puppy up, guys.
All right. To sum up about sex, prayer. We earnestly pray for what? Right ideal. I pray for guidance in each questionable situation. I pray for sanity. I pray for the strength to do the right thing. And I had a sponsee called me up after his first date with this one girl. She was doing the work. She was doing the deal. He said, she invited me upstairs. What should I do? And I said, what's her last name? He didn't answer that question. I said, you might want to go work with another guy then. It doesn't sound like your heart's in the right place. Sounds like your dick's in the right place. So, it says, if sex is very troublesome, we throw what? Ourselves the harder into helping others. And I didn't tell him what to do. I merely suggested that maybe you're placing a selfish motive ahead of your own. Because I've heard his fifth step, and I know what his sex motive is, his sex ideal is, and it wasn't her. But she said yes, and sometimes you hear that, and you're not thinking right. So it goes on to say, we think of their needs and we work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache.
Because if you cave in to this imperious urge, you're the one that's going to suffer.
Yeah. Now it says, if we've been thorough about our personal inventory, we've written down a lot. I like the way Scott Redmond put it. I don't know what a lot is. A lot may be 2 pages. A lot may be 25 pages or 200 pages. Don't know. But if you've been thorough, you've written down a lot. We've listed and analyzed resentments. We've begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We commence to see terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill towards all men, even our enemies. Guess what? We started praying for them. We look on them as being sick people. We have listed people we've hurt by our conduct, and we're willing to straighten out the past if we can.
All right. In your packet, you're going to see this inventory sheet. It says, review of other harms. Why is that sheet in there? He just read it. It says we've listed the people we have hurt by our conduct. Just because you're angry at somebody, you're resentful at them, doesn't mean that you hurt them. Just because you're scared of something doesn't mean you hurt it. You hurt some people in that sex inventory. But how about walking into Home Depot and stealing a hammer? Who did you hurt? You hurt you and all the guys in this room because the prices are going to go up because there's other people doing the same thing. You hurt the employees. You hurt a lot of people by thieving, and that's just one example. You hurt those other people by breaking into their homes, their cars, their businesses. You know the things you did. I'm going to give you a real I'm going to give you an example of something that happened in my life. My mother, in May of 1986, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. In July, she was gone. Other became nocturnal, which meant that she stayed awake at night so she could be around people. She was awake when everybody was sleeping. She slept when everybody was awake. It's just the way terminally ill people become. They become nocturnal. So I took it upon myself to do some outside issues and stay up with her all night. Well, I'd do so many of these outside issues that I'd be gritting my teeth and just all bound up. Well, the doctors had given her a medication called a Brompton's cocktail. It's a very high-powered narcotic. It comes in these large brown bottles. It's a liquid. And it's powerful. It gives her a quality of life in her final days. I'm not taking into consideration that my mother is dying and that she's in pain and this is a medication that is substantial for her. When my teeth were gritting and my jaws were tightened up, I'd go inside and I'd drink her cocktail to take that edge off. The end of this story is I never denied her the medication she needed, but the point is this. It wouldn't have mattered. I would have taken her cocktail because I needed it. My mother's dying. It didn't matter. And if I do that to my mother, what do you think I'd do to you? You follow? That's a harm. It's what I was capable of. And that's the way I ran my life up until the end of 1987. This is a very important inventory. Who did you hurt? What did you do? What did it affect? What's your part in it? Please don't overlook this sheet.
Bottom of 7, he says, in this book we've read over and over that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you have already made a decision,
third step,
and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, fourth step, you've made a good beginning. That being so, you've swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself.
It's all you.
You know, it's the short guys in this deal. Yes, sir.
I want to clarify that life that you just sold to, so you guys can see the stereotype.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, guys, we're going to embark into the next chapter, chapter 6. In the title of this chapter, I'd like to bring it to your attention. It says, Into Action. Y'all okay. With us back there? This chapter, yes, sir.
Oh, you're good.
Thank you so much.
Well, he's good at it.
All right, it says it's into action. It's not into thinking. Into action.
Having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it?
So they're assuming that you've actually taken time to write some stuff down. Okay?
Book says we've been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path.
So we're talking about this attitude thing again. Attitude about ourselves, we're really not pieces of dirt. About our fellows, they really don't dislike us. It's that warped perception. And about our Creator. All-loving, all-knowing God. Huh? I'll give you this. Y'all with us? It says, we have admitted certain defects, and we have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our inventory. That's that fourth column. Now, these are about to be cast out. In the West here, I'm sure that you guys have seen guys use a cast net. That swinging, slinging motion. You good?
You know, I think there are some Moroccan fifth steps going on back there.
You know, Eddie, I got to tell you, you're going to hell for that behavior. You and this little guy over here, this Indian guy.
Yeah, all right. So the book says now these are about to be castanets.
I don't know if this late session's a good idea or not.
Yeah. It says this requires action on our part, which when completed will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter. This is perhaps difficult, especially discussing our defects with another person. We think we've done well enough in admitting these things to ourselves. There is doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient.
You know, when I wrote all this stuff down, I thought, wow, damn, Larry, sure did take a lot of guts to do that. Whoa.
You're the
and
man.
Then I got to do what? Oh, no, I've already written this down. This has got to be enough.
It says, many of us thought it necessary to go much further. We will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reasons, plural, why we should do so.
What is that?
The best reason first, if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking.
It's the only reason he gives. Pretty good reason, though, huh?
Flip over to 73. First paragraph says, more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life.
More than most people. So it tells us that other people lead a double life.
We are very much the actor. Wow, sounds a whole lot like that third step stuff, doesn't it? You know, the actor forever trying to arrange the scenery, the lights, the ballet. We're very much the actor. To the outer world, we present the stage character. This is the one I like my fellows to see. I want to enjoy a certain reputation, but I know in my heart I don't deserve it.
Can y'all hook up with that?
Best example I have of that is when I, 2 days before I got sober, I was the sous chef at the Ansley Golf Club. And they gave me the Employee of the Month award. And I really wanted that Employee of the Month award. And when I walked up after they announced my name, I had beer on my breath. And I stood there and they gave me that placard. They gave me that coveted thing to hang on my rear view window that said Employee of the Month parking space, and that $200 check, I wanted to puke on them. Not because I was sick physically, but because whatever admiration, whatever validation, whatever feeling I thought I was going to get. Because, see, I busted my butt for that thing. I showed them all. I wanted to enjoy a certain reputation, but I knew in my heart I didn't deserve it. You know, there's a guy out of Gil S. out of Tennessee, talks about standing in front of the people, preaching the word of God. And as they're filing past him at the end of the service, shaking his hand, saying, great service, Gil, great service. He's like, I got some liquor back in the rectory. Great service, Gil, great service. I got some nudie mags back in the rectory. Great service, Gil. He goes, if you really knew who I was, you wouldn't like me. I enjoy a reputation. I put me out there that I think you will like. How many people can relate to this? If I told you who I am, you'd ask me to leave.
Yep.
Wow. It says we're going to skip over to
the middle of page 75, but before we go there, there's some things I want to share with you. We're going to skip some stuff because keep in mind, this book was written in the 30s. At the time that it was written, there was approximately 40 people on the planet that were sober. So if you were in Des Moines, God forbid, and you got a fourth step you're sitting on, you needed to share it with somebody. So what they did in these preceding pages is gave some examples. Some were very poor examples of some folks that you might consider to take your fifth step. We don't have to worry about that today. There's more people in this room right now than there were on the whole planet sober at that time. We have sponsors. If you need to go to a priest, go with it. But the point is, there's no sense in wasting your time going through this. It's dated material.
Top of 75 says, when we decide who's to hear our story, we waste no time. We have written inventory and we're prepared for a long talk. There's our time frame. Don't know how long a talk is going to be. Might be 30 minutes, might be 11 hours. Don't know. Says we explain to them what we're about to do and why we have to do it. Of course, our sponsor is going to realize that we are engaged upon a life and death errand. These are the specific instructions now, starting the next paragraph on how to give a fifth step.
And these enclosed here or the fifth step, promises. Remember we talked about all these promises? These are some powerful promises. Listen what's up.
Specifically, how I'm supposed to share a fifth step, it says, I pocket my pride and I go to it. I illuminate every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once I've taken the step, withholding nothing. That's how I'm supposed to give a fifth step. I'm supposed to cast it all out there. Once I've done this, withholding nothing, I'm delighted. I can look the world in the eye. Any shoe guys in here? They wouldn't look you in the eye. You wouldn't look people in the eye, because if you looked them in the eye, they'd know exactly who you were and they'd ask you to leave, right? But all of a sudden now you start looking people in the eye, because guess what? You realize that you're not the most despicable SOB on the planet. You're no different. The guy you've just shared your fifth step with, guess what? He's done a lot of the same things and felt the same things, experienced the same things. All of a sudden, I'm no different. I'm not unique anymore. I can look the world in the eye. I can be alone at perfect peace and ease.
Can y'all relate to that? You had to be in a room full of people, but now you don't have to be. You can stand out here on this deck with all of us inside, and you're not longing for anything. You're at perfect peace and ease. Yeah. I know you know what they're talking about. Yeah. This guy's been sharing stories with me about being out in the woods. Frank's been sharing about. These guys go out alone, and they're at perfect peace and ease. They have no longing to be fulfilled by other contact. And look at Bill back there. He knows what I'm talking about.
And there's a difference between being alone and being lonely. I can be lonely in a room full of people, but I can be alone without being lonely. Because what the book tells me right now is, my fears fall from me, I begin to feel the nearness of my Creator. I may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but I now begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. I feel I am on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe.
Okay, there is your fifth step promises. End of step five. Any questions on the fifth step? Good? Cool. Then we return home. And it says when we do that, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. There are people, we run into them all the time, they say, well, I live in a recovery house. I live in a sober house. There's TVs blaring and people hollering and screaming and cooking and slinging pots and pans. Doesn't say you go home and find a place where it's quiet. Go find a place where you can be quiet, this thing. Because after all, didn't we discover that this thing is what kept us drunk? We find a place where we can be quiet for an hour.
Carefully reviewing what we've done. Prayer. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. You know, Larry alluded to that the fifth step ended with those promises. This is some post-fifth step stuff, pre-sixth step stuff. Kind of falls into that nebulous gray area. But it goes on to say, taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first five proposals. Prayer. We can ask if we have omitted anything. God, have I left anything out? I'm building an arch through which I'm going to walk a free man at last. Is my work solid so far?
And there's that arch chart that we've been showing you all weekend long.
Yeah.
You're going to pass through this thing, the spiritual structure, free.
Yeah. I like the way Brian P. talks about it. I cannot begin a spiritual journey on a lie. Have I left anything out through omission or commission? And I usually suggest to my guys when I hear a fifth step, that, listen, there may be that one thing. If I didn't hear one of the three or four biggies, at least one of them. I usually share the ones that I had. But if I don't hear it out of their mouth, I suggest to them strongly that you go back and review the bottom of page 75. Look at this stuff. Have you left anything out? Is there one thing that you're going to take with you to your grave? Is there? You might want to give me a call. You might want to share it with somebody if you got one. Don't take this into tomorrow.
Christian is alluding to something, and it's not in this book. It kind of is, but between the lines, this is my experience, okay? When I gave my fifth step, my guy that heard my fifth step, that took my fifth step, I would share some stuff, and he could sense that I was a little nervous and uneasy, and he would share some of his stuff. And he would sometimes match my inconsistencies with some of his own, and he taught me. When I'm taking a fifth step, I tell my guys, I said, listen, there's more to this thing than me just taking your fifth step. I'm teaching you how you're going to take your fifth step, take fifth steps down the road. That's the way this deal is. And typically what will happen, and this is what Christian was talking to, you get that guy, he comes in, he sits down, and he swears to himself, I'm taking this thing to the grave. I'm not going to tell this to anybody. But what happens is all of a sudden they get comfortable, and they realize this ain't as bad as this thing said that it was. And they go, oh, by the way, I didn't write this down, but. And they tell you that thing that they swore they'd never share with anybody else. Anybody ever have that experience in here? See what I'm talking about? It's typical. Huh?
My sponsor called it the big secret.
Right.
There you go.
That's the one thing that generally fuels our drinking real good, because so we can't get over it.
So we're done with this fifth step, and we ask if we've omitted anything.
Is my work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have I skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Am I trying to make mortar without sand? These are all questions that I go through my self-examination. Now, top of 76, if I can answer to my satisfaction, I then look at step six.
Guys, this is that hour. He's just giving you an hour's worth of exercises. And if you blow through those questions and you're comfortable with them, then you sit for the rest of that hour. You don't go home and wait 10 minutes. Do what the book says. It suggests an hour. Take an hour.
It says, we have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Am I now ready to let God remove from me all the things which I have admitted are objectionable? Not that the society told me are objectionable. I'm looking at that fourth column. I'm over and over again seeing how selfishness, self-seeking, dishonest, inconsiderate, fear, all of these things, I'm admitting these things are objectionable over and over and over again.
And step six and seven, I want to expound on this just a little bit. You're in this room, and I know you are. You're thinking, what are those steps? Well, I'll tell you, they're the forgotten steps. There's two paragraphs in our entire text about them. Later on, Bill reflected back on them and said, you know what, these things deserve a lot more ink. And he wrote them up in the 12 and 12, and I invite you to go there. My experience is I had a guy come along in my life, and he gave me a year of his life on those two steps. It says we look at step six. It's not a working step. It says, the step says we're, past tense, entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Continuing the thought that Christian started, we've just sat with somebody. My longest period taking a fifth step was 14 continuous hours with a defense attorney out of Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and it was brutal. But it was a must that we had to do it in that time frame. And when he was done, over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, this guy had admitted all these defects of character, these flaws in his makeup. He was sick of these behaviors. We're entirely ready means you've hit a bottom with these behaviors. You with me? Your sex dishonesty, your thieving, your stealing, your manipulation, all these things, and you're tired of acting out on those behaviors. We're entirely ready. That's a bottom. Okay? And you go, okay. And then you got a prayer here.
We asked this question. It's a real simple one. Do I believe that God can take them all? Everyone, if I still cling to something that I will not let go of, I ask in prayer, God, help me to be willing.
Sixth step.
And sometimes the willing just to be willing to be willing. That's a prayer. You know? Like Johnny S. out of a...
Johnny Siegel out of Studio City, co-founder of Cocaine Anonymous. He went to Norm Alpe and he says, man, I'm really struggling with this thing, this sex thing. I'm a lust monster. He's a womanizer. Long hair, dark complected, good looking sucker, nailing everything it was. And Norm says, you know, just because God takes away your sex desire is not going to leave you barren or boring. He says, why don't you talk to God about it? Ask God to help you with this. Because Norm was scared to death, or Johnny was scared to death if God removed his sex drive, that he'd be, that's what he thought he was losing, that he'd just be left barren. So he says, okay, Norm, I'll go home and try this. He got quiet and he says, God, I ask you to remove from me my sis. He says, God, I need your help with removing the sis. But that's not the deal. It's the misconduct, the misuse of the sexual instinct. Okay? Uh-huh. So when you've done this, you've become entirely ready. Step six is done. Okay? And then it says, when ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I am now ready. I am now willing that you should have all of me, the good and the bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defective character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. And there's that word. Amen. We have then completed step seven. Now, we've disclosed all these character flaws that are in our makeup. This is what we were made up of. I invite you at some point, go home and read 6 and 7. Get somebody to take you through it that's got a handle on it. This man pointed this seventh step out to me. The last paragraph in the seventh step in the 12 and 12 has got so much meat. And here's what it says. The seventh step is where we make the change in our attitude, which permits us with humility as our guide to move out from ourselves and toward others and toward God. The whole emphasis of step seven is on humility. It is really saying to us that we now ought to be willing to try humility in seeking the removal of our other shortcomings, just as we did when we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol. Remember that willingness? That desperation? Please God help me. Remember that? When you first came in here, it's saying to apply that same willingness and humility to this. And came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Steps 1 and 2 right there. Bam. If that degree of humility could enable us to find the grace by which such a deadly obsession could be banished. Here it is. Then there must be hope of the same result respecting any other problem that we could possibly have. Wow. Not most or some, all. 6 and 7 of forgotten steps. Please don't blow by these.
Now, we finished a fourth step. We shared a fifth step. Became entirely willing in 6. Humbly asked him in 7. That can take a weekend. By the time I'm done writing and I've done sharing, I've got a willingness and a humble willingness to have him remove it. We can do that in an hour and a half. I've sat and talked to a guy once who was on step 6 for over a year. And I'm of the opinion I can hover anywhere. The way I do it with my guys at home is we do a fifth step, go home and do the hour. Are you entirely willing that God can remove these things from me? Do you believe that He can? Cool. Ask Him. We've got an 8-step list. We made it when we took step 5. Go out and start a 9-step amend tonight. You know? That's one of the key things about this is the momentum of moving through it. Is that, let's move. How free do you want to be? Do you want a little bit or do you want a lot? You know? It says, now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead.
That comes from the book of James. Faith without works is dead.
All right, let's look at steps 8 and 9.
Look at them.
We have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory.
There you go. So you've already got the list. New guys are going, I got to make a list. You already got it. You already made it. How cool is that?
Yeah, please don't burn your fourth step until you have an eight-step list.
You know, I got my guys, and we do this thing like y'all, and we got a big fire pit, and they do a big spiritual bonfire. You got a fire out here. If you're here doing a fifth step, and you're thinking, God, I'm glad with that, I'm going to burn this thing. Don't do it.